harping on wars we fight, griping about the great things of the week. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and causing God's peace. If you don't love it, lead it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight beside me. Guy who claims he just don't believe the fact. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking down with life, I'm fighting and fought and died. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside me. Running down with life. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warning. And you run down my country, man, you walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fight inside of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you are on the fighting side of me. I'm going to play this week's program, the Ethnostate, this week featuring, of course, our usual chairman, our chief host, William Johnson, the chairman of the American Freedom Party, our producer, Ken Givenin, and this week myself, Paul Fromm. I was the co-host here from Canada, and we had a lot of good discussions on this week's Daily Ken. This week's Ethnostate. It started off with random mobs attack whites in black mobs attack whites in Minneapolis.
Hello everyone, this is William Johnson, Chairman of the American Freedom Party, with another edition of The Ethnostate, with today's co-hosts, Kevin MacDonald, Paul Fromm, and Ken Givenin. Thank you guys for showing up. Now, Kevin, you're not on all the time, but the running joke of this show is that people in the chat room, they write and says, how many minutes are going to go by before Bill Johnson says, time to make white babies. And so I usually start the show telling them to do that. And as a result, this last week for emails, I got a couple of emails from someone who sent me pictures of their children and their family says, see, we're doing it. We're making white babies, beautiful white babies. So that was good. But then the point is that you just don't make them. but you raise them, you rear them. Actually, you can't say raise. My mom, when I was growing up, she said, Billy, you raise animals, you rear children. So you guys got to rear them to be good citizens of the community. So there I got my obligatory make white babies and rear them properly out of the way.
Well done.
Okay, thanks. Now, the first article I'd like to talk about is the first on the list. Ken, can you tell us all about that? Tell us what's going on in Minneapolis.
Yeah, the first article on the list is this challenge in, can I call it a challenge, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where what is going on there is black thugs are doing what black thugs do, and that is attacking white people. So arrested are, let me check the article here, 20 black males, 18 who have been charged. What these guys have done, many of you have seen the video, they just randomly choose typically white men and they just beat the crap out of them. According to the news article, 20 people arrested, 18 of them now charged, all connected to brutal robberies downtown Minneapolis. The attacks were caught on surveillance video taking place in August. Police say groups of people would target one person, assault them, and often take their cell phone and their wallet. One guy, they took his pants. It's just horrific what these guys are doing. Now, before I throw it back to you, I saw this all the time when I was in high school 50 years ago. People are shocked by what they're seeing. But I went to a black majority high school. This was normal. They'd grab some white kid and beat him to the point where it's like he was in a serious car accident. And the only way you could deal with it, of course, the administrators pretended it wasn't happening, well, most of them. The only way to deal with it, you just had to stay away from black kids. Had to avoid them. And that was, guys, that was 50 years ago, half a century ago. So you go back to 1919, you had the Red Summer, the riots. Go back to 1838, the conception, or not the conception, but the inception of what we now know as Oregon. They passed the lash laws that made it illegal to be black in Oregon. And the reason they stated for those laws was because this type of ratchet behavior, which leads me to believe it's innate, it's pathological. But that's what's going on.
Okay, first off, I would like to talk to the august man of the movement, the real scholar among us. What's your thoughts on this, Professor McDonald?
Well, it was an incredibly brutal beating. I don't usually watch videos, but I watched that one a couple of times. And yeah, so somebody ran over him with a bicycle. They kicked him in the head. It was incredibly brutal. And of course, the media accounts did not even mention that they were black and that the guy, the victim was white. I'd be surprised if any of the victims were non-white.
Well, could you see in the video, could you see the race of the perpetrator and the race of the victim?
Yes, very clearly. Especially after his pants came off, okay? After his pants came off, you clearly see his white legs. He was white, and the other guys were clearly black.
Well, was there serious damage, long-term damage to the bicycle and to their knuckles? Or
I haven't heard anything about the damage to the... I mean, this guy, he didn't get up, and I think, he was pretty seriously injured, but I don't know any more about it. They didn't.
All right. Well, what's come to America is next coming to Canada. So what's your thoughts on this, Canadian pundit?
Well, I saw that attack on the internet, and it really was shocking. My comment actually deals with something that occurred over the weekend, and one of my big bugbears is the managed media coverage of something, of any event that involves blacks in a negative way. The initial media story that came out Sunday was that the night before, somewhere in the city of Mississauga, in a courtyard near townhouses, five people were shot and injured, and one 13-year-old was killed. And the apparently an ice cream truck had pulled up, and lots of people from the townhouse complex had come out to buy ice cream. And at the other end of the court, somebody was videoing a rap video. Van pulled up with seven people dressed in dark clothes of some sort. They pulled out semi-automatic handguns and bang, 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 bang. There were 100 shells found around the place, and that was the story. Well, a story that on one hand scares people. People think, well, maybe my neighborhood's in danger of the same thing. Well, they didn't tell you. They didn't give you the address. And once I found out the address, it's an Ontario housing or welfare housing area that's basically full of Jamaicans and other blacks. I guess the only clue was the fact they were filming a rap video. And the few further details that have come out are also very, very uninformative. We're told the people that were shot were not the intended victims, and the police know the motive. That's it. Now, they don't mention it was blacks, the killing blacks. They don't mention that all the victims were black, and all of them were apparently not the targets. But then when you hear they fired 100 rounds and only hit 6 people and only killed once, you just know it's black crime, and they must be the world's poorest marksmen, short of blind men. Of course, if you hold your handgun on the side like this, we're not told this. You either have to be quite streetwise, like I guess I assume I am, or you're needlessly fearful. You would say, well, it might happen in my neighborhood. Well, probably wouldn't happen in your neighborhood because it's mostly white. It's a black neighborhood, and blacks are doing it to blacks all the time, but we're not told that because, well, that might just give people the wrong impression that we're not all equal, and that perhaps some of the immigration we've been accepting has just not worked out very well.
Well, when I was living in New York City and going to Columbia Law School and dating my wife at the Manhattan School of Music, at that time you had the mafioso, the Italian mafia, was really powerful in New York, but it was waning. Why was it waning? Because the Jamaican gangs were taken over, and the Jamaican gangs were so much more scary, so much spookier than the mafia, that the Italians didn't want to have anything to do with them. They had to steer clear because the mafia, Jamaican mafia, was literally as bloodthirsty and cruel as you can get.
Well, so, I live in my new place, Hamilton, Ontario, is basically a mob town. And there have been a couple of mob killings in the past couple of years, and they're always targeted. They don't open fire in a crowd hoping to hit the intended victim. They ambush him usually at his house or someplace like that. Not that I'm in favor of the mafia, but this is just outrageous stuff. And it's just the absolute managed news. Trump is absolutely right. Fake news, fake news, fake news. You lie, you lie, you lie.
To me, it's savagery just for the sake of savagery.
What? Yeah,
when I went to school with these guys, there was no logic to it. They were just behaving like animal instinct. Now,
they opened fire on a crowd of people who were trying to buy ice cream in the hopes they're going to hit people involved in making this rap video at the other end of the court. I mean, this is lunatic.
But really, you to give them credit, they've taken hitting to a higher level. I mean, the Italian mafia, they did it one way, and the Jamaicans show how they can do it so much more over the top. So, you know, we need to learn from this cultural enrichment.
Well, you're right. I guess now I understand why diversity is our greatest strength.
That's it.
Okay. But in any event, to get back to the main article about what happened in Minneapolis with the blacks beating up the whites, we have in our chat room the infamous Sean Donahue. And you know what he did? As soon as he saw this video, he went and he typed, he's really good at sending emails out to everybody. He sent emails to all of the city councilmen and the mayor of Minneapolis, and he didn't like his answer that he got from the public relations person at the city of Minneapolis, because it was just snarky, and it was calling him a racist. and just said all sorts of bad things about him. So what he did is he rolled up his sleeves and I'll show you, and he sent his emails to every single assemblyman in this in the Wisconsin legislature. And not only that, he CC'd everybody he knew, all of his friends, all of his foes. And so I got when I came into work this morning, I got 15 emails. 12 of them were from Sean Donahue, copied to me, and then 3 of them were legislators from or assemblymen from the state house. And they, if you look at them, it was just replete with self-righteous virtue signaling. Oh, you're a racist, leave us alone, da da da. But the point is, Sean Donahue got their attention. So that was better lobbying than anything that's done in a while, because he got some responses. And since the responses came to me, well, I thought, well, I'm going to respond back. So, you know, you have the concept of good cop, bad cop. Well, in this situation, it was Sean Donahue was the crazy cop, again, the same cop. So he said all sorts of extreme crazy comments. And I was just the epitome of decorum and moderation. And I commented positively on some of these things, and I sent those off. So at least that they're getting the message. They may not like to hear it, but they're getting it and they're reading it. So I think that kind of effort by Sean Donahue was just amazing. And my fault, I haven't got any responses as a follow-up, but because I told one of these guys, oh, I agree with you. That he's going to blanch white as can be. So what's a white national doing agreeing with me? He's going to run as fast as he can from that email. But it is a sad situation where we cannot even walk down the streets of our towns without fear of being, well, we've always had the fear of being beaten up by minorities, or not minorities, the non-whites. But now we have the fear of it being brushed under the rug, swept under the rug, and not brought to light because it's black on white crime. And that's just unacceptable. The good news is things are changing. People are waking up. If you read the comment section of any article that talks about this, most of them are all saying more things more extreme than anything we say, and would get us all kicked off of YouTube if we read them out loud on air. Okay, any other comments on this before we move on to the next topic?
Does anybody have any idea of what is behind this? I personally believe it is innate behavior. I don't think they can help themselves. And I know there are a lot of black people who are exceptions. They don't do this kind of thing. But I think it's inherent.
I think it's made worse by the atmosphere in Minneapolis, where they're, I don't think they seriously think they'll be punished. Minneapolis is such a, center of political correctness and leftist. Well,
Also, I think that maybe the innate behavior is magnified by the current situation in which we live, because these kids are taught by their mothers, not by their fathers, because they don't know who their fathers are. Right. They're taught by their mothers and by the school that they are the victims of white hatred. And not just that, they're taught by Joe Biden. They're taught by Joe Biden and Pocahontas and all the rest of them. Beto guy from Texas who's as white as they come, they all teach that get whitey. And so when these kids are raised to hate white people, and it magnifies that portion of their innate sentiment towards violence, it fuels a dangerous combination of hatred and violence that they take it out on us. And so it's the good thing is that this is happening now as opposed to 20 years hence, because we have a large enough number of our people that we can wake up and we can repel these attacks and have our own ethnostate. Where if we wait so long that we get like the South African and the Rhodesian governments, then it's a lost cause. So
it makes a lot of sense for the media not to report the racial aspect of this, because it is something that really triggers white people. I mean, when you see that kind of stuff and you see the hate, and we see it now, you know, even like Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times, and places like that, we see anti-white hate. Slate Magazine, Huffington Post, all these places. You know, it really makes people more conscious of being white and having a white identity and not looking forward to the future and being, you know, more concerned about things like immigration, that sort of thing. Minneapolis has admitted all these Africans, and that's another big part of their problem.
Well, see, we have this grand experiment in Western civilization where we are suppressing white consciousness, suppressing our heritage, and we're told to look beyond race and not have any pride in our own inner feelings. And so much so that yesterday I read in an article that in England, 90% of the youth, and I'm not sure, I think it was the millennials or younger, feel that they have no purpose in life. They feel that their life is meaningless, and they're just floating around in a sea of drugs. So this grand experiment of where we abandon our heritage, our race, our culture, our moral fabric, has resulted in the youth of every white nation really feeling hopeless. And so the concept, I think everybody right now, the worst thing is to be called a white supremacist. And all of us in the movement eschew that because it's a negative term. But if everybody thought their own race was superior, that would be better all the way around. There wouldn't be interracial marriage. You'd have pride in your group, and you wouldn't want to betray your group by acting feral. So I think everybody should be encouraged to think that your people are the best. And it's okay to say, oh, go, you know, Texas Christian Horned Toads, you know, or go BYU Cougars, but you can't say go white race. So I think we need, you know, I guess, Kevin, what's your take on that? Is this a permanent destruction of our Western psyche, the fact that we've been so demoralized that we can't recognize our own heritage?
Well, I do think that is where we have headed and where we are for to a great extent. And but that, you know, that's one of the things that I do think is waking people up, though, is how much hatred towards white people that we see, and the much advertised kumbaya future is simply not going to happen. And I think that's why it was good for us, people like us, to emphasize this, because we know the media will not name names, but at the same time, people reading those articles, they'll probably know this, because those are the stereotypes. I mean, they'd be shocked if they found out this was a bunch of white kids from the suburbs just doing this, being a crap out of this kid, you know, and interracially and everything. I do think that would be the standard default assumption, that this would be a black ghetto kind of inner city kind of thing.
You know, a couple of minutes ago, Ken asked, well, why is this happening at this time? And I think there are two factors. Number one is that white institutions, or let's say Jewish-controlled institutions that blacks will take as white, have pumped them full of this entitlement and victimhood for 50 years. It's not just their own preachers or leaders that tell them they're victims. Society tells them they're victims. And I think that liberates the worst element to do bad things. And the other factor, in Minneapolis, I saw this on my daily dose of poison, CNN, when I was looking at it earlier today, and apparently some spokesman for the Minneapolis police said that their budgets and numbers have been progressively cut down, and they just don't have the presence on the ground that they used to. Up here in Canada, I was actually station hopping, and I came across an East Indian making comments about the shootings I was telling you about, and something interesting. That was that a couple years ago, the province banned carding, and that there's been a real spike in Negro gunplay ever since. And carding, I'm not sure if it's called the same thing in the United States, but a policeman could stop you, and he could ask you for your name, ask to see your ID, and you had to tell him. They moaned and groaned that this unfairly targeted blacks. Well, the blacks would tend to be more likely the ones who would come to the police attention up to no good rather than some 85-year-old white woman in a walker. So they banned that. And that allowed the police to talk to people, especially the potential bad guys. And if they didn't like what they heard, or if they noticed a big bulge in the, under Tishon's jacket, they'd have reasonable probable cause to arrest them. So it kept gun-toting Negroes resulted in some restraint. That's gone, bang, 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 bang.
The indicator to me, Paul, is not what they have in their pocket, but if they have very dark skin and kinky hair, I stay away from them. I mean, and that may sound horrible to some sensitive ears, but my experience has taught me that's the thing you got to do. Let them prove themselves. You know, that's not my job. But my experience has been, as a people group, there is an elevated, accelerated pathological aptitude toward extreme violence, and you can't just ignore it.
So, Ken, you said you were at a majority black high school. Did this really change you? Is that where you got your opinions from, your experience back then?
Yep. Talk about red pill. The first day I walked onto campus, I discovered that the world that I thought I lived in was very different. I mean, I was attacked the first day I walked on campus. Fortunately, I had a friend with me who's a really big guy, and he managed to run these kids off. But had he not been with me, I would have been like I'd been in a car wreck. Well, I would have been the guy that you see on the screen 50 years ago.
Well, in my area, as opposed to Canada, carding means something totally different. Carding is where you take out all of the oil and the defects out of wool. And you have to card sheep, but you don't have to card alpacas. And alpacas are the tamest, sweetest animals. They'll never get out of their enclosure. Whereas the sheep and the goats, man, they'll get out of anything. They're escape artists, and they're mean, and they'll butt you, and you got to watch out for them. So if the concept is the same, you don't have to card the alpacas because their wool is already perfect, but you got to card the feral lambs and rams.
Well, so why don't we send you our Jamaicans, and you can send us your alpacas.
Alpacas, okay, there you go. But no, we have analyzed what the effect of the current society is on blacks and how it fuels their violence. But I have always had hope that the effect on our white youth will not be so negative or long lasting. One person will get beat up, but then it'll help us wake up the other people. But one incident that happened recently really makes me worry for our youth. Our cleaning lady, she's white, and she has a beautiful grandson who's as white as they come, fair and blonde and blue-eyed, and he's just a young kid. And he comes up and rides some of our horses sometimes, and he told his mother, he says, and he goes, of course, to a public school in Southern California. He says, "Mom, I hate my skin color. I wish I were a different color." Skin. And that made me realize, the effect on our people is devastating. I always thought we were above that. We could always be proud of who we were. But I now meet girls who are dating Indians from India. And I told them, I said, your kids are going to want to be white. Don't you marry an Indian. She says, "Well, really? I don't think so." So this effect on our people is devastating, and before it's too late, we got to wake up, and we all got to pull a Sean Donahue and send emails to all of our legislators all around the country and CC everybody we know, and then maybe eventually something will happen. But in any event, let's move on. And I mentioned earlier about how in England the our youth are so demoralized that they have no hope for the future. The next article that I want to talk about is an incident that took place in Great Britain. So can you tell us all about that, please?
Yes, and before I do, let me remind you, I think Kevin has to check out about quarter till, so you need to decide if you want to keep going or just close out at the quarter till.
I can go a little longer.
Okay, well, cool.
I wanted to check out, so that's bad news. But okay, we'll stick around. So go ahead, read it.
This is from the Telegraph and Argus in Britain. A man has been jailed for 13 years for savagely raping an 11-year-old girl who leapt in terror out of a first-floor window to escape him. Then he gives his name, which is African, I can't pronounce it, forced his way into the child's bedroom, seized her by the throat, and pushed her to the floor while she cried and begged him to stop. 31-year-old took off her pants while she struggled. She bit his hand and kicked him. He pulled her hair, banged her on the floor before raping her, and a prolonged, according to the story, sexual attack. All right, he got 13 years. Had this happened in the United States 100 years ago, this guy would not be alive today. The men of the community would have lynched him. But I'm wondering, where are the so-called feminists? Why aren't they outraged at this girl's demise and your demise at the rape?
Let me explore the facts a little further. Did this man know the woman, the girl? Was she a family member? Was she a relative? Was she white? Was she black? Do we even know what she was?
Well, the story doesn't tell us. You got to keep in mind, in Britain, they're very careful about giving the identity of victims. But no, it does not tell us if she was white. Doesn't tell us if they knew each other. They probably didn't, but we don't know. My presumption is she's white. Yeah. So, don't know.
But you say that if this happened in America 100 years ago, he would have been lynched. But 100 years ago, if he'd stolen a horse, he'd have been lynched. You know, and this is so much worse than horse thievery. So at one point, I mean, this is another aspect that we've gotten so out of kilter on what's right. I mean, we value human life so much more than the benefit of society, where I think we need to start moving back maybe towards we value individual life less, particularly those that are the worst portions of society. I mean, it used to be in England, if you steal a dog, that was a felony, and a felony was punished by death. So they changed the law so you wouldn't execute someone for stealing a dog. Maybe we need to go back, go towards that direction a little bit more.
Well, 100 years ago, this African would not have been in Britain or in the United States. With healthy immigration policies, he wouldn't have been there. Now, that wouldn't have perhaps affected, American-born or blacks, and there'd be hardly any in Britain. But this is a further fruit of absolutely dysfunctional immigration policies.
Yeah. Well, 100 years ago, I think I've told a story before. My great grandfather, after whom I was named, was head of a church congregation, and he always carried a pistol with him. And one time, someone would got up and said something in church that my great-grandfather didn't like, and he was on the stand. He stood up, pulled his gun, and said, "You better sit down or I'm going to shoot you." So there was a lot of violence going on from the right, from the proper direction. And now we got violence coming from the congregation that we need to rein them in. But what's the solution here?
I don't know about the solution, but I'd like to expand a little bit on Ken's point that where are the feminists? This is something we see over and over again in Europe and in this country. Sweden, for example, now has one of the highest rape rates in the world. And still Swedish feminists are completely on board with migration of these people who are known and very much prone to that from the Middle East and from Africa. So they value this diversity. They more than they value their supposed constituents. It's an amazing phenomenon, really, that the people on the left don't have a sort of consistent moral perspective on things. They have a summum bonum, you know, the highest good is immigration, diversity is our strength, and anything else is just ignored and brushed under the rug. It's amazing.
Yeah, but is there hope in the feminist movement? Because one aspect of feminism, or the feminist movement is good, is they see a problem and they're active in wanting to change it. So they're misguided with what the problem is, but the activity, the activism is there. So is that a more fertile ground for conversion than you have the dissipated American who doesn't care, who just goes along with the crowd, doesn't get involved? I mean, and we see feminists finally waking up and saying, hey, you know, my activism is a good thing, it's just directed in the wrong direction.
My opinion is the word feminist is a misnomer. These people are not feminists, they just use the word. They don't care about women's rights. If anything, they are misogynist, they're anti-woman.
Well, that's the women portion of it, but I think the men that are involved in this are maybe just out to you know, meet women and have their way with them. Because, like, I remember in Los Angeles in the 60s, there was, I think, some sort of cult group called the Children of God or something like that. And what they would do is called flirty fishing. They get all their women, and this is similar to what Charles Manson did, is he get all these girls to go out and use their sexual wiles to bring these guys in. And so I think that a lot of the guys are attracted to the feminist movement because they want to make it with feminist girls. Although if you take a look at a typical feminist girl, I don't know who'd want to make it with them.
Hate men. I mean, they really do.
Okay, well, that's society we live in. Okay, let's go now to the next article. Slave ship role-playing lessons ends due to parental complaints. So, Ken, give us the skinny on that.
This is in a middle school that is north of Indianapolis, not terribly too far from where I live, but it is in Rushville, Indiana, and they have this lesson, which involves role playing. And so the students are bound, and they are yelled at, and they are treated as they imagine slaves would have been treated, and they put on an imaginary slave ship, I guess, to impress upon their minds how horrific slavery was. Some of the parents objected, and what I found interesting, at least according to the newscast, the parents who objected were black parents. They did not want their little black children to experience that. They thought, you know, it's over, it's a thing of the past, let's get on with it. But because parents objected, the government school there decided we're not going to go forward to this with this. My thoughts on this episode is, why slave ships? I mean, there's a lot of things in the past of our history that it would help for kids to role play. For example, what trauma did Europeans go through when they were on ships coming to the USA? Role play that. What about, I've got a photograph of Olive Oakman on the screen. She was kidnapped, enslaved by Indians, tattooed, her younger sister allowed to starve to death. Parents massacred, her brother was left to die, but he survived. Role play that. Why not have a role-playing class of settlers being attacked by Indians? If they want to be consistent, which obviously they don't, I think they should do that as well, but they're not going to.
So what would have happened if a bunch of white parents said, I don't want my kids to participate in role-playing with slavery? I think then the white parents would be looked upon as being racist because, you know, they don't want to... You don't want to point all the bad things your ancestors did. You just want to shove it under the rugs. So we can't win for losing.
So true.
But this calls to mind when I was in Mr. Nordquist's class at Ida Patterson Elementary School in fifth grade in Eugene, Oregon. We had a similar type of role play, only this role play It was taken straight out of a play from Boy's Life, which was the Boy Scout magazine, which you wouldn't have that now because you can't promote Boy's Life probably. But what it was reenacting all of the tortures that the Aztec did against their own people. And we got there. I was the chief priest, and I had a stone axe, and I was knife, and I was cutting the heart out of Dan Cooper, you know. And everyone was squealing, and you know, and we were just showing what savages these Aztecs were. And now you can't do that, but you know, we have more Aztecs in our school system here than we ever did when I was growing up. But you still can't do that. So. Yeah, times flat, times change.
It's a typical kind of manipulation that we see. They take advantage of the fact that these kids do have empathy for other people, and they really highlight this, and it's a way of making these kids feel guilty. We've known that before on the show, you know, how so many white people hate themselves and their race and everything. It's because of things like this, and it's a very effective technique. It's been going on for a very long time.
And I remember the same lesson plan that we had when we talked about the atrocity of the conquistadors. They said that a few white conquistadors were able to subjugate tens of thousands of Aztecs. And what was the reason they gave that? Because the conquistadors came on horses, and the Aztecs thought they were gods. They thought they were just one single organism connected together. And I thought, that's the stupidest, racist, in a bad way, racist thing I ever thought of. Of course these Indians could tell the difference between a horse and a man on a horse. We're trying to say that they thought they were the same one animal. That's the stupidest thing I ever heard. Even when I was in fifth grade, I thought that. But that was the excuse that was given in the textbook then of why Cortez was able to conquer the Aztecs. Because they thought they were gods, because they're all four-legged, you know, human-type animals. So it's great. Okay, in any event, let's move off of my past from the fifth grade, and let's go to the next article. The next article is actually a little bit of good news. Charlottesville. Ken?
What is happening in Charlottesville is, this is in your department, Bill, because of your legal expertise, but apparently there is a law in Virginia that says you cannot take down flags and monuments. That, and I'm not sure how the law reads, but apparently if it's something to do with the military or the war, you can't take them down. And so this statue is left stand. So that is a major victory for the Unite the Right movement. However, keep in mind this law was passed back when Virginians were a little more sane than we are today. But that statue that was the center of the controversy, my understanding, of the Right to Life rally, it's still there, and according to the court, it's got to stay there.
Thoughts, Canada, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, that's certainly a good law, and one wonders why were all the authorities that were doing their best to ban the Unite the Right rally, why did they not know this, or if they knew it, why did they not act? That could probably have diffused the whole thing. You don't have to have a big rally because the statue's not going anywhere. I think it was partly the fear that it would enjoy the same fate as so many other statues had and monuments across the United States in that orgy of destruction of white culture that followed the shootings in South Carolina in Charleston, with Dylan Roof.
You know, I think that there is a portion of every human being the desire for self-harm or self-flagellation. And this particular article shows my own desire for self-flagellation, because I read this article in all places in Huffington Post. I thought I'm going to go to the comments and see what Huffington Post says about that. And I was surprised. Now, of course, there was a lot of article comments saying take the statue down, but there were a lot of people on Huffington Post defending the right to keep the statues there. And then one person wrote back and says, well, they weren't heroes, they weren't soldiers, they were traitors. And you know, you got to rip down, because they're not the same thing as under the law that protects our military, because they were traitors. And then someone wrote back and says, they weren't traitors, there was a different country, they left America, they created the Southern States of America, and they were not traitors, they were supporting, you know, what they believed in. And then going back and forth, and someone says, well, yeah, they were traitors. Well, you don't see a statue of Aaron Burr anywhere. And I got me thinking, you know, I think it'd be kind of cool. I'd like to have a statue of Aaron Burr. You know, he was a vice president, and I can't remember what the bad things he did, but I think that'd be cool to have one. I certainly wouldn't want to take it down. I'd like to put it up. Maybe just because we're all a little bit want to overthrow the society. But in any event, even on Huffington Post, there were defenders of the Confederate statues.
That is why the left hates the internet. That's why they hate what we're doing right now. Because we just blow them over. Just bulldoze them.
Oh,
it's,
I know.
It's overwhelming.
I know. They fear our 600 viewers. They think that we're going to really go out there and influence the world.
But we are, compared to what they're doing.
Yeah. Okay, that's true. All right. Any comments on this before we go on? It's been a big issue, and another comment is these articles, they often quote George Orwell, 1984, not the articles, but the comments on the articles, and they just point out, they take excerpts from 1984, and they show how we are living in that society to a T, and this is one example, how they're erasing all the history and doing all of this double speak or whatever it's called.
Of course, that's what the communists did in the Soviet Union when they took over. They destroyed the churches and just eradicated the old culture. And that's really what's happened here. I mean, you have to realize that the 1960s was a cultural revolution that has had just, you know, incredibly transformative effects on society. I mean, it's probably the biggest upheaval really since the Protestant Reformation. That this is something that has just completely upended our society and changed it dramatically. When you import, you know, whole new people, when you get rid of the old culture, this is a whole new ball game here. And I think the worst is yet to come. But you know, we're trying to fight against this, but it's an uphill battle at this point.
Well, that was your era. Professor McDonald.
It was. It sure was.
So were you, I bet you were at Woodstock with the flower powers.
I read about it, but yeah. I was at the University of Wisconsin, just as bad or worse.
Yeah.
By the way, we have 50 people.
Professor McDonald, comment about the 60 generation was really bang on. That was my generation, the you know, peace, love, and freedom of speech. And that generation has gone ahead and basically betrayed most of those ideals, but perhaps no ideal more so than freedom of speech. Campuses today are absolutely mental straitjackets. It's interesting that many of the really bad leaders of the European Union, the intellectual children of Kuhnhof Kalergi, were campus radicals in the 60s. Angela Merkel, of course, was a Communist Party operative in East Germany. Jean-Claude Juncker, who's the head of the EU, was a campus radical, and various other ones were. I mean, not just kind of a little left. Some of these people were Maoists. I mean, that's the left on steroids.
Yeah,
I'm proud to say I was never a hippie.
Okay. Well, while Paul Fromm was putting flowers down the barrels of rifles, I was listening to Ernest Tubb and the Texas Troubadours. I didn't listen. That was my culture. I didn't listen to any of the rock and roll music, because rock and roll music was evil. You know, face cards were evil. Rock and roll is evil. Cigarettes were evil. So I stayed. I listened to Ernest Tubb.
Waltz around Texas.
What?
Waltz around Texas.
Yeah. Or
I wasn't sticking flowers in National Guardsmen rifles. The group I was involved with had protests outside the United States consulate against all the commies and the socialists who wanted the end of the war in Vietnam. And we we were for the war against communism, and I might have rethought my position in the light of hindsight. But you know, we were quite anti-communist, but we would have been the minority in our generation.
Well, I didn't realize this until many years later, but your compatriot of the Guess Who, when they did American Women, you listen to that song, and it says, we don't need any of your wars, we don't need your ghetto scene, we don't need all that kind of stuff. You keep out of Canada. You know, I don't need you, American Woman. And I also says, you know, that's kind of true. America has led the Western civilization down the toilet for the last 50 years, and that Guess Who guy, whatever his name was, Burton Cummings, I don't know, really was right on. Okay, let's move on. Let's talk about the other one. Ken, tell us about this NFLer who's nabbed for faking a hate crime.
This is kind of an interesting story because this guy was an NFL player, never actually played in a season game. I don't understand how that works. I guess you have a roster, you can fill it up, pay these guys huge amounts of money. I mean, they all get at least six-figure incomes, I understand, but he never played, and he was on eight different teams. The story is, he went into business, had a couple retail businesses, restaurants, and he decided, allegedly, to scam the insurance company, so he went into his own businesses. He spray-painted racial epithets, things like swastika, make America great again, because in his mind apparently there's no difference. Just trashed his own businesses, and he was kind of found out because he was seen driving the getaway car. He just left all kinds of clues for the police to come up with.
It just seems like all of these alleged hate crimes are all perpetrated by the victims. I mean, don't they realize that we don't do that? I mean, Paul, how many weeks has it been since you spray-painted the swastika? Probably several, right?
It's been quite a while, yeah.
Yeah, so we just don't do that. We just don't do that every day like the media makes it out to be.
Well, it seems to me, Bill, that the concept of white privilege, that's a type of fake hate crime because it's not real. When they call us racist and white supremacist, that's fake. The whole thing is fake. The whole idea that America is awash in racism, that it permeates every nook and cranny of our culture, that's all fake. It's just not true.
Well,
you haven't told us the important point. Now, this is a very low IQ crime. Who was the perpetrator?
What was the guy's name you're asking?
He was a Mensa applicant.
Well, his name was not Jesse Smollett. His name was Edon Kaufman.
Okay.
And he was from what, County Tipperary?
I don't know where he's from. The crime occurred somewhere in Georgia, Atlanta area.
Well, he wasn't a quarterback. He was a running back, probably, or whatever they are.
How can we get a job like that where we're on the roster, we don't play for eight seasons, we get a big paycheck. As long as we didn't have to go out and play, could qualify for that. How do we get in on that gig?
Yeah, I don't know.
I'd like to find that.
He's certainly more athletic than I'll ever be. But you mentioned the issue about white privilege being an illusion. And I'm often called a task, because I recognize white privilege everywhere I go. And of course, I want to do away with white privilege because I want there to only be white people in my country. But just today, on the way home for lunch, I had my wife with me. We stopped for a little restaurant, a little Mexican restaurant, and it was very kind of upscale restaurant. And I walked in with my wife, and we were treated royally, much better than anybody else. Why? Because it was white privilege. And whenever I go into a ghetto area, and I walk in, and of course I have a white shirt, but it's not so pressed or whatever. But they show deference. They show they're pleased that I walk in to patronize them. I'm treated like a little like a movie star. And it's like when my wife and I, when we lived in Japan, she was playing in a symphony there, and I was a lawyer. And whenever we would go down the street, they would come up. This was before there were a lot of foreigners in Japan. They'd ask for our autographs for being white. And similar, when you're in these non-white areas in Los Angeles, they're so flattered that a white couple will patronize them that they treat us a little special. And so there is white privilege. And the fact is, and I mentioned this over and over again, there are billions of white supremacists in this world, and they're all the non-whites. They think the whites are better. And of course, you ask us, we think that the whites are the sorriest lots out there because we're the only ones that's given away our countries. But that's...
This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated late in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.
In days of yore from Britain's shore, would the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours, which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever.